Good morning, and thank you very much for coming today. This is the, what are we calling this? The report of the Transatlantic Dialogue on Terror. We did this a year or so ago after our first phase of the program. I'm delighted to say that in the second year, I think that the dialogue has flourished in substance, in the quality of the scholars it's attracted, and in becoming one of the central fora for discussing things that are going on in the world of radical Islam in particular, and terrorism more broadly. I want to first of all thank our funders who have been very generous in supporting this, the Bosch Foundation and the National Intelligence Council. Just to remind those of you who aren't, or to inform those of you who aren't familiar with the Transatlantic Dialogue, we began this program in the dark days of 2003 when it seemed as though the two sides of the Atlantic were moving farther apart, if that's geologically possible. And we seemed to be in a position where we were not going to be able to talk about what some of us considered to be the really enduring threats that would face the Western partners. This started out, therefore, as a small, clean, well-lighted place, to use Hemingway's phrase, and I think it's grown into a bigger one, and it's benefited from the fact that both sides of the Atlantic, I think, are increasingly sharing an understanding of the threat, and we hope are moving back to a place where we can have more coordinated policies. In the last year, we held meetings first in Berlin in cooperation with the foreign ministry there. Then we, as is usual in our sort of home and away pattern, we had a meeting here in Washington in July. Is that correct? And then we were in The Hague in December, where our partners were Klingendahl and TNO, the sort of foreign policy research institute in part, and this new institution which seems to be doing a bit of everything for the Dutch government, including all kinds of modeling, homeland security, intelligence work, and the like. We covered an enormous amount of material in these three sessions, and we did not confine ourselves, nor have we ever confined ourselves, to just issues of radicalism in the United States and Europe, although those were on the center of the plate. We also discussed Southeast Asia, the Caucasus, the Middle East. We had very rich sessions, I think, in every conference on aftermath and the consequences of Iraq for radical Islam. We discussed, I think, one of the recurrent themes that I'd like to talk about is actually how those particular local jihads were merging in or were in a kind of synergistic relationship with the global jihad. And this was, I think, one of the areas in which we had the richest discussion, and that is the interweaving of global concerns, local grievances, and the like. It tied in with this, I should add, were a number of sessions that we had on the internet, which has become, in a sense, the vector par excellence of this kind of new consciousness of radical Islam, of Salafism, and of the what Olivier Waugh has termed the new Ummah, or the neo-Ummah. In the European context, we discussed this in particular with relation to the self-starter cells that we have seen that carried out terrorist attacks in Madrid, in London, and also in the case in Holland of Mohamed Bouyeri, who killed the Dutch artist Theo van Gogh. We had very interesting discussions because there remains some scholarly difference over the extent to which individuals are being motivated by things that are happening in their communities, by their own sense of alienation within, in particular, the European context, by unemployment, by the sense of denial of access to education and opportunity, but also by concerns about what's going on in their home countries. We had the very distinguished English researcher Alison Pargeter talk about her work on particularly Maghrebian immigrants in the UK, and the extent to which they were motivated and their attitudes were informed by concerns about what was going on in their home countries. But at the same time, there was a strong feeling that particularly among young European Muslims, we are seeing the growth of a new sensibility that is both attached to the local and informed by the global. We had superb presentations by the Israeli scholar Gabriel Weimann, who I know his book I think will be out next week, and I strongly recommend you all have a look at it. It's being published by the United States Institute of Peace Press on the internet and terrorism. He documents the simply explosive growth in internet sites, but he also internet sites associated with terrorism, but he also gave us a really in-depth look at how iconography has influenced this, how, for example, in one riveting discussion, he told us how within days of one of the hostages in Iraq being decapitated, the same image was being replayed only in a child's game with a video of young Muslim children. We don't know exactly where they were, probably in the occupied territories, literally in the very same poses that had been used in this beheading in Iraq. And he underscored that this was an example of how radicalization is now being sort of narrowcast. It's being tailored, fitted for different audiences that are both very young, teenage, young adult, and the like. Just to return to that issue of global and local, though, for me, and I think for some of our other participants, one of the hallmarks of this development, which we discussed, was the case of Bougueri, and it's worth recalling some of the details of that attack. It was a very Dutch attack. Bougueri rode up to his victim on a bicycle in Amsterdam. I can't think of anything that would be more Dutch. He then shot Van Gogh, got off the bike, went over to the dying man, took a kitchen knife and plunged his manifesto into the man's chest with a kitchen knife, plunged his manifesto into the victim's chest, and then in a sort of recapitulation, reenactment of what had been going on in Iraq, decapitated him, or at least slit his throat, giving Europe its first such act. The manifesto itself, if you haven't read it, I strongly recommend it, is a a psychoanalyst couldn't have done a better job in concocting it, because in it he complains bitterly about what Israelis are doing to Muslims in the territories, what the U.S. is doing to Iraq, and at the same time complains about Dutch administrative law and a proposal to screen Muslims for radical ideas, an idea that had been put forth by the Dutch, the Somali-born Dutch legislator Hirsi Ali. So it's a fascinating window into a mentality that no longer distinguishes between global and local, and in which all these different grievances or outrages, however you want to see them, become mutually reinforcing and strengthen the ideology of radical Islam. I'm not going to take too much more time. I want to pass it over to Julie Smith, who will talk a bit about the issues of integration and cooperation. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And we'll leave plenty of time for questions at the end.
Thanks, Dan. I just wanted to, like Dan said, say a few words about some of the work that we conducted on the subject of integration in these dialogues. This hasn't been a topic that has been kind of on the first page of most agendas for transatlantic conferences in the last decade or so, but obviously in recent years, it's been an increasing focus of transatlantic exchange, and particularly in our project, we found it time and time again coming really to the center of many of our exchanges and dialogues. We looked at various different models that exist inside Western Europe in terms of integrating Muslim communities, and the models differ considerably, as most of you know, for a couple of reasons. I mean, first and foremost, the Muslim community inside Europe is by no means monolithic. You have the Turks in Germany and the North African communities in France and the South Asians in the UK and all the rest. You also have a number of legal systems that vary considerably from one country to the other, and the history and culture in all of these different countries clearly shapes policy in different ways. Now, the conventional wisdom over the last couple of years has been that the UK model has been the most successful approach to integration, that being this pluralistic, multicultural approach to integration. And there's some evidence that there's truth to that. I mean, in the UK, you do see very high levels of political participation of the Muslim communities. You see them increasingly in positions of power and influence. You're seeing, for example, nightly television broadcasters who are Muslim, or you see them establishing more and more positions in local government institutions. And of course, their patterns of settlement in the UK also seem to be more diffuse. But of course, with the London attacks, we found that a number of folks in our dialogues were kind of stepping back. A lot of the integration experts out there were questioning this multicultural approach and looking specifically at whether or not the UK's very tolerant approach to radical preaching, for example, was the right path forward and the best way for tackling these integration challenges. There were additional questions there about whether or not multiculturalism actually leads to more assimilation, or maybe it leads to more isolation. And you've seen a lot of debates in the UK on these types of issues in recent months and over the last 2 years or so. Of course, the same is true in the Netherlands. This is often identified as another bastion of tolerance and openness inside Europe. But of course, as we saw with the London bombings and in the assassination of Van Gogh, as Dan just mentioned, these incidents or these attacks were conducted by young Muslims who on the surface appeared to be highly integrated and assimilated. But of course, as we tragically found out, they had quietly become radicalized over time. And so we've had a lot of exchange and dialogue in this project about how difficult it is to actually measure or understand to the degree to which these communities are actually integrating. I think folks are tempted to look at things like, well, how are they dressing, or what are they eating, or how are they settling throughout the country? But none of these seem to be really the ideal indicators. And so, again, none of us, I think, Europeans and Americans alike, had kind of the perfect equation for measuring levels of integration. But we talked about this as a continuing challenge. Now, from a transatlantic perspective, I think there was consensus, and I think it's well supported by many of the experts we brought into the dialogue, that Europe faces a much more serious challenge on the integration front than the United States does. And that's due to a couple of reasons. I mean, first, you're looking at a much larger population of Muslims inside Europe than you are in the United States proportionally. Those that have come to the United States tend to be more or highly educated than those that we've seen settle inside Europe over the last couple decades. Of course, the political culture and the identity formation, the fact that the United States promotes and supports hybrid identities has helped the U.S. side of the equation considerably. We not only have Muslim Americans, but we have Polish Americans, Irish Americans, and all the rest. And this hybrid identity is something that's much more hard to find inside European borders. But that doesn't mean that the United States isn't without its own challenges. We did have some very interesting exchanges in our project about what's going on inside the United States. Jenny Abdo has come to a number of our sessions and talked about her interviews with Muslims in the United States and their concern about this climate of suspicion that has taken root after September 11th that's dramatically affected how Muslims identify and view their own identity. What we've seen in the last couple of years, I think, is and Jenny has mentioned this on several occasions, is certainly the pursuit on the part of American Muslims of a more pronounced Islamic identity. That doesn't necessarily mean a growing radicalism, but we are certainly seeing more requests in offices for prayer time or prayer rooms. We're seeing more and more women in certain communities put on the headscarf, requests by students to build mosques on university campuses and the like. So while this certainly is a challenge for Europe, a much greater challenge for Europeans in many ways, I think this will continue to be a transatlantic challenge. And as we see immigration patterns shift on both sides of the Atlantic and the political context changing and certainly public opinion changing, in my view, in a very negative way, this will be an area where I think transatlantic exchange would be quite beneficial on the question of integration. We issued a couple of recommendations in the report based on our various rounds at this, and one of the things we mentioned is the need for political elites, particularly inside Europe, to foster a deeper or greater national debate on this question of integration, particularly as we're seeing the anti-Muslim sentiment rise on the European continent. I think we need a more constructive dialogue between European leaders and their publics about breaking down stereotypes, making the case for coexistence, identifying ways to improve the socioeconomic standing of these Muslim communities, etc. Secondly, we mentioned the need for a forum for Europeans to trade best practices with each other. We've been surprised by how little exchange goes on among, say, French integration experts and German integration experts and Dutch integration efforts. It does exist. There are conferences. There are a few forums, but we haven't found really a proper institutional forum, say, either in the EU, although I hear this is underway, or in some sort of other international organization where European countries can come together and exchange lessons learned and best practices. Certainly, as I mentioned up front, the challenges differ, and I don't want to belittle that fact. But at the same time, many of these countries are facing some of the same challenges. How do you create multicultural awareness programs for law enforcement officials, or how do you identify bilingual teachers for various educational programs to teach the pillars of Islam in public schools, or how do you broaden youth participation in things like the Muslim councils? All of these challenges are commonly faced by a number of countries in Western Europe, and we think there'd be added value in bringing Europeans together to, again, exchange best practices. If I could, I'd just like to say a few words about the transatlantic relationship more broadly and some of the things we've learned in this dialogue. As Dan mentioned, 3 years ago when we started this, the relationship was looking, pretty tattered given what had happened in regards to Iraq and a number of other tense and contentious issues. But many of our recent exchanges over the last year in particular have shown that Europeans and Americans largely see the threat of terrorism in the same light. Of course, there are differences, but while we might have started off here, I think we're starting to narrow the gap a little bit. Both sides of the Atlantic are recognizing that we need a full spectrum of instruments and tools to combat the threat of terrorism. And I think neither side wants to see disagreements actually derail some of the good cooperation that's out there. And so the result has been today a much more pragmatic relationship between Europe and the United States that's results-oriented. You can see that in the good work we're doing together in Afghanistan or increased law enforcement cooperation, many of the EU-US efforts that have been launched on container security or extradition. But that doesn't mean that the relationship isn't without its problems, and we can all quickly point out the stumbling blocks that we've encountered, particularly in the last couple of months. Iraq certainly continues to cast a very dark shadow over the transatlantic relationship, and we found that any perceived link to the U.S. agenda in Iraq can make joint undertaking in a lot of these areas very difficult or in some cases impossible. The greatest damage in our eyes recently has been caused by concerns or accusations about torture and abuse at U.S. facilities. Certainly Guantanamo comes up time and time again. The press accounts of the secret prisons in Europe have also cast a very dark shadow over the relationship, and we're concerned, and you'll see in our report we mentioned the fact that we're very worried that this could pose a serious threat to joint intelligence activity between Europe and the United States. And so for that reason, one of the recommendations we issued in this report was the need to act now to prevent lasting damage to the intelligence relationship between Europe and the United States. We urge the United States to take very seriously the concerns that Europeans frequently bring to the table over Guantanamo. We also urge the U.S. to evaluate ways to close that facility, avoid perpetuation of the legal gray zones that continue to pop up. And we also ask that Europeans try and resist the temptation to really exploit the issue of human rights for political gain, which we seem to have witnessed on several occasions over the last year or so. Lastly, I just mentioned we have a recommendation in here for a strategic dialogue between Europeans and Americans about various aspects of counterterrorism. Neither the EU-US summits nor the NATO summits, or even for that matter the dialogue between the EU and NATO, provide any sort of forum where Europeans and Americans can come together and talk strategically about the fight against terrorism. Whether you're talking about differences that remain over threat perceptions or the use of force, or more tactically, how do you prevent suicide bombings, or how do you try and counter the technical innovations that have been created in Iraq and then are popping up elsewhere. And so for that reason, we really would like to see either some existing institution take on the task of serving as a counterterrorism forum of sorts, or perhaps down the road we would need a new institution of some kind to tackle these issues. So I'll leave it at that. I know we want to turn it over to Karen and Mark, who've been participants in this dialogue, for some additional comments. We will go to Mark.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. First, I want to thank both Julie and Dan for inviting me to participate in all three meetings. And what I want to talk about is really a little bit more about the process. I think that all of you can read, and you can all read about, the report itself. What I want to tell you is a little bit the atmosphere of those meetings. First of all, it was a great opportunity for me because I met people whose books I read or books that I ordered after I met them. and it kind of created a network that probably may become as powerful as a network we're facing in terms of getting information about them. One of the interesting things looking at it is that there were some similarities and differences. In terms of differences, let me kind of, first of all, one of the differences was obvious in the Berlin meeting. What's the percentage of German population that smokes? it was full of smoke. That's an obvious difference. It wasn't so in Holland. But on the other hand, coming here in Washington, we had Puritanism, the American Puritanism, that reared its ugly head. And we saw that in terms of the rebellion that we had at our table. Well, Judge Balthazar Garzon, who was oblivious to this, of course, as he would be, the rebellion was about wine. Actually, they served us a meal without wine. This is the American way. Europeans were very upset, and I think that you guys chipped in for a bottle of wine to just keep us quiet, and that was the right thing to do.
We're using that as a model for counterterrorism efforts.
I think that probably drinking wine would benefit this counterterrorism strategy. A similarity, actually, were probably even more striking. First of all, the willingness and to participate by a lot of people, I think, without being remunerated, if I recall. It really kind of led to a very frank and open exchange of view, and it was remarkably free from political posturing. So even though Julie actually talked about some of the differences between the Europeans and the Americans, especially about Iraq and Guantanamo, I actually found our session to be very free of them. We almost bypassed this issue. Those are the public issues in the dialogue, but this was not really what happened in our meeting, which was kind of fairly interesting. And what I found is that we actually had a convergence of views from both sides of the Atlantic. And this is really, really surprising if you think about it. Now, I was thinking about it this morning, said, what led to this convergence? And I think part of it is the two of you selected people that knew something about terrorism. Basically, we didn't really have any of the self-appointed talking heads that we see on both sides of the Atlantic and talk about terrorism all the time. The folks who had been invited were often government officials who were within the counterterrorism field, Foreign Ministry, Ministry of the Interior, and some academics. And this basically people who are actually dealing with facts. So all the observation, analysis, and conclusions on most of the talks were really driven by the facts on the ground. And since the facts are the same, you had a convergence of view. And so I'm actually very, I didn't realize this, but I think that this dialogue that initiated by CSIS really is leading to perhaps this new paradigm of an evidence-based terrorism research. And the notion is to actually apply scientific method to the study of terrorism. And if you start doing that, you're going to get a convergence of opinion. So that leads, all those meetings probably lead to an accumulation of experience. I mean, I learned a lot every time I actually went abroad and when foreigners came here about their own experience within their country, and they shared it with us, and it was really fascinating, both in Berlin to actually listen to the German experience and, of course, the Dutch experience when we were in Holland. And so that kind of leads us to kind of question, what's the baseline for terrorism? What is actually normal, typical for terrorism? I mean, is it what most of the talking heads are talking about, or what are facts on the ground telling us? Who are they? How do they go about doing things? What are the trends? And in terms of counterterrorism, what worked and what didn't work? This actually was fascinating. On a more abstract level, there are some similarities and differences between Europe. The similarity are that we are facing a common threat. I mean, that's fairly obvious. But there are differences. And the differences, we all realize what they were. And if you kind of look at the facts, we actually had about 24 people arrested for this type of terrorism in this country, no more. And most of these cases are really going south pretty quickly, except for one or two exceptions. In Europe, they arrested thousands. And, of course, you account that there's a difference in number of Muslims between the U.S. and Europe, but, they actually have similar populations, 300 million here, 340 million in Europe. And in terms of a population of Muslims, they're not all that different. It's about 15 to 20 million in Europe, and here it's about 6 to 8 million. So even accounting for the difference, it won't account for the difference in arrests. What it tells us is that probably what Europe is facing is more of a homegrown problem, and what we're facing is probably a foreign problem, an import into the U.S. Julie mentioned two or three theories of what may account for these differences. I have several others, but the whole point here is that this type of dialogue is really the start of talking about, kicking around some ideas about those differences and similarities so that we can advance the field, our understanding, and have practical implication for policy. Thanks.
Thank you. And like Mark, I wanted to thank Julie and Dan for inviting me to most of your meetings as well. I wanted to talk a bit about this report because I wasn't able to attend some of their meetings. But I do think that the report and the dialogue have made a really valuable contribution to this larger debate that has been out there over the past four years, or 5 years, really, since September 11th. And the importance of these meetings has been primarily that they've brought in more than the usual suspects, as Mark mentioned. So they brought in some really interesting researchers, young researchers, new researchers, Europeans, Asians, Africans, etc. And they've been really addressing some of the fundamental gaps that that we still face in dealing with this threat. And I think one of the important contributions really this report makes is that you know, there's a lot of humility in discussing what we don't know, and I think you don't find that very often. Most people really want to tell you what the answers are, and we really have so much more work to do. So I think that's a really important point, but also that there's really a sharp focus in this dialogue and the report on the larger question of root causes, which people have been talking a lot about, but there's been very little practical work done. If you read all the public pronouncements, European and American, about our ways of approaching root causes, you really see that very little has been done since September 11th. So I think that you've made, you know, this report has made an important contribution in the dialogue for those reasons. My comments will be brief. I just wanted to talk about two of the recommendations and then maybe raise some speculative questions for the panel. The two recommendations that I wanted to focus on, really, Julie raised them. And the first is this question about developing a larger strategic framework between Europe and the United States, which is really fundamentally important and in many reasons has been at the root of why Europe and America have not been in agreement since September 11th about what to do. And a number of people have been saying that we need to develop this framework, and it's here. And I think that maybe future work could really start to nail down some practical ways of doing this and trying to develop it in a way that would make sense to Europeans and to Americans. So I wanted to maybe press you guys for future discussions to really let's try to get more practical about that. The second point that you raised in the report is how important it is to share best practices. And I think that's also something that, you know, that we should try to do more of. I worked in London for the last however many years, and I was working with the British police a lot, really since early 2002. And they had a really interesting way of reaching out to the Muslim community in the UK. And, you know, 6 months prior to the war in Iraq, they were going out to Islamic centers, to mosques, and saying, you know, if there is a war, we want communications to remain open, et cetera. They have done a lot of really innovative things that I think that other parts of Europe and the United States could really try to tap into. And I'm sure there are many other really interesting experiments like that in Europe and the United States that we need to really share and publicize much more. Then I just wanted to try to torture you guys a bit and maybe press you about some speculative questions. And I guess one, over the weekend there was an article in the Post about if we, the United States, or anybody bombs Iran, they will let loose Hezbollah on, you know, Europe, America, wherever. And I really wanted to press you both about what this might mean for this larger movement that's really evolving so fast. I mean, if we want to also try to be anticipatory about this threat, what you think that might mean for this threat that's become much more locally focused, even though still using this global rhetoric. The second point really is about what Julie was talking about earlier. If you use an example of the UK, which I know the best of the Muslims in the UK largely come from South Asia, but it's becoming much more of a mixed community of Somalis, Kosovars, West Africans, and it's becoming much more diverse. And I'm just wondering, because still today most of the Muslims in the UK are not in the middle class like they are in the United States, is this more of a threat or is this potentially less of a threat? I know these are speculative questions, but I think that we need to start thinking about these in a grander way. So, and I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to thank our panelists for their comments. Let me do a couple of things. First, let me try to take a crack at Karen's question. I thought actually the Post do we have any Post reporters here before I say this? I think the Post did a great job at reinventing the wheel in that article. It's been I think it's been recognized among specialists for a long time that a military confrontation with Iran would likely lead to terrorism. Now, it's not a lot will depend on the actual military action, whether the Iranians think they're better off riding it out and not provoking additional responses. But you know, given the mindset of the leadership, it's entirely possible that we would see terrorist acts, usually based out of embassies around the world. I guess the real question that we would have to ask is whether or not this would not effectively resurrect state sponsorship, a waning phenomenon in terrorism, and lead to a possible, shall we say, networking of a state with a non-state actor, and in this case, al-Qaeda, or al-Qaeda affiliates, or fellow travelers, what have you, which I think would be a very, very dangerous development, and one that I hope policymakers are considering carefully. You know, I remain convinced that Tehran will not see it in its interest to give al-Qaeda a weapon of mass destruction, as in fact a full page ad in today's Times suggests. Nonetheless, you know, there is a possibility that we would see enhanced cooperation. And as some of us pointed out in 2002, the level of contact, cooperation at a very low level between Iran and al-Qaeda was a lot greater than it was between Iraq and al-Qaeda. And there remains, you know, a number of senior al-Qaeda officials under house arrest in Iran to this day. As for your question about the heterogeneity and class of British Muslims in particular, well, you know, I think that the work of lots of scholars, beginning with Gilles Kepel and running through Mark Sageman, are we running the gamut from A to B there? Has suggested that class is not the major determinant. In fact, in virtually every major terrorist conspiracy, we've seen a combination of high and low, at least in terms of education, if not in class. And you could imagine that there would be plenty of affluent radicals. I mean, after all, historically, terrorism and revolution are the product of the theoried classes, or the leisure of the theoried class. I guess that was the classic formulation. The fact that, you know, an awful lot of people do feel alienated and denied opportunity in Europe heightens the threat. Before opening it up for – did you have anything else you wanted to add? Before opening it up for questions, I just wanted to do two other things. The first was to echo Mark's remark, which I think has been one of the really key findings or the key results of this process, which is that if you look at the counterterrorism community itself on both sides of the Atlantic, you will find an increasingly striking consensus on a whole range of issues, consensus that is often at odds with sort of the accepted wisdom in policy circles on counterterrorism. And you know, I guess it's our job in the think tanks and the job of independent scholars and the like to highlight those differences and try to gain greater currency for the ideas that are coming out of discussions like this. And the other thing I wanted to do was simply to thank two people who are not up here on the dais, whose work has made Transatlantic Dialogue a success, and that is Aidan Kirby, who's over in the corner, who has labored mightily to make this a success, and Andrew Tabler is right up here, who's been just a terrific support for the program. With that, we're open for attack. I see a CSIS hand in the back. Sarah.
Hi, Sarah Meddleson, CSIS. Julie, can I just get you to talk a little bit more about what sounded like a European commentary on torture and abuse and its role in this. The comment about exploiting human rights abuse for political gains. What did you mean by that? It was a little cryptic, but interesting. And it's not just the U.S. who would have engaged in erosion of torture norms and laws. The British are debating it, discussing it. So how much of that played in your conversations, and how much do you see it playing in future conversations? I can see one panel shaking his head.
We can give Mark a chance as well if he wants to jump into this. But I would just say, I mean, Mark was right. I mean, by and large, at our dialogues, every time we hold this, we're a little taken aback by how much consensus there is in the room. And there isn't a lot of – I mean, we still occasionally have the conversation about whether or not the war on terror is the proper term to be talking about the fight against terrorism. And we can go round and round in that, and we do frequently. But we don't go over and over and over the he said, she said routine over Iraq, what happened in 03, and lining up, you know, the chronological list of events of how we got from A to B. But what we do find, and it's not necessarily a focus of these dialogues, but certainly on the margins we've heard, and you see it in the press, as Mark points out, and above and beyond when we put counterterrorism experts in a room, concerns about human rights abuses in Guantanamo. We know that's the darkest shadow over the relationship right now. This administration has had to deal with it front and center on many occasions, many visits to Europe over the last 6 months or so. And even Merkel, who came in and now has a wonderful relationship with this administration, has been quite firm on this issue. So it is there, and I think there's no denying that this will continue to cast a shadow over the relationship. In terms of politicians using this issue for political gains, I mean, certainly we don't want to belittle this issue and say, oh, Europeans shouldn't have any right to bring this topic up. But we do see instances, and I think you can find this pretty easily, where the political elites in Europe have used this to their benefit. I mean, some would argue that, you know, Chancellor Schroeder was very opportunistic in terms of his interest in using Guantanamo for political gains during the last federal election and other issues, including Iraq, to the point where it certainly helped him, and it has helped other political leaders, because the level of anti-Americanism remains so high throughout Europe, everywhere you go. Anyone who travels there, as most of you well know, it's alive and well, and certainly a problem. So I think it helps them, but it doesn't help the transatlantic exchange and the good work that we have to do together. And political elite, I mean, what we find is kind of quietly counterterrorism experts pulling us aside and saying, look, we get it, we understand the threat, we're all working on this together, but it's very difficult for my chancellor or my president or my prime minister to get up and talk about the value of a close relationship with the United States right now. And so for that reason, we said, let's be cautious about using the human rights issue for political gains, because you don't want to fuel the fire. I mean, while the relationship at the policymaking level is quite good right now for the people day in and day out doing work on counterterrorism, it's not particularly good at the public level. And so to the extent that we can help that by not fanning the flames, so to speak, we wanted to throw that out there. But Mark may have another take on this. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
It's not so much a different take. It's the transatlantic dialogue was really not open to the public. And therefore, this facilitated an exchange, a frank and open exchange, where we on this side of the Atlantic did not deny that, you know, such things occurred, perhaps in Guantanamo, or that Iraq was not fueling the expansion of the pool of terrorists. I think we all kind of agreed that this was the case. What really happened within this closed meetings, we actually did have journalists, but it was for non-attribution. I don't think that anybody wrote about it that I recall. Did anybody write?
No. Actually, what we it wasn't discussed in the framework of, you know, finger-pointing, but rather the extent to which, as Mark suggested, some of these practices are driving radicalization. And I recall in particular the Wall Street Journal journalist Yaroslav Trofimov, I believe, spoke about how issues like this were just, you know, deepening
America's and more broadly the West's image problem in the Muslim world. And by the way, those of you who don't already follow his work, I heartily recommend it. He's one of the best writers on the subject. But, yeah, it wasn't in the sense of, you're violating all the canons of international behavior. I don't think there was actually a lot of disagreement about on the moral issues. This was really about what's good and what's bad in terms of driving radicalization.
Yeah, basically what we had was actual dialogue, fruitful dialogue, as opposed to finger-pointing and something like that. So even though in the public domain it's a real issue, in the private actually it wasn't.
Actually, there were a few hard questions, as I recall, for Philip Zelikow when he spoke at dinner one night, but that's another issue.
More questions?
Hi, Mark Goldberg from the American Prospect.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Dan, you just mentioned that having a large, alienated Muslim population that's denied opportunity heightens the terrorist threat. And I'm wondering if there are any data points or anecdotal evidence that might help make that point.
If you just look at the personal biographies of most of the people who have been arrested and their own experiences, you have a clear sense of the marginality of an awful lot of them. I think Mark has done much more in-depth work on this than I have, so I'll just pass it over to him.
Yeah, if you actually look at the people who become terrorists, it turns out 84% are part of the diaspora. And Bob Lakin, who was a little bit skeptical about it, went to Europe to actually check me out, and he found out that it was, for Europe, was 87%. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of data.
Rick Clark from Chevron. I noticed in your list of participants there were no representatives from the global business community. I was wondering if you could maybe lay out a little bit of your thoughts, open the panel, your thoughts on what role the business community has.
Well, it's a good point. And it's a reflection of the fact that we were bringing in people who were primarily experts just on either in the various academic disciplines that are related to this, or were government practitioners or journalists who had covered it. We certainly would be not only more than open, we'd be eager to have members of the business community who could relate their own personal experiences in dealing in particular areas where, for example, there is, say, in Nigeria or other areas where you see radicalization on the rise and posing a particular threat. In round one, in the first phase of the dialogue, we did get quite practical in terms of talking, and this is something we hope to continue here at CSIS, and talking about Western engagement, particularly in the form of either capacity building in Muslim governments or in the activity of Western NGOs in particular parts of the world where Islamization is rapidly moving ahead, and where anti-Western sentiment is growing. That would be an interesting thing to have business participation in. Clearly, to the extent that foreign businesses are offering opportunities to different groups, and in that way, through the classical means of prosperity, ameliorating some grievances, that's all the better. Otherwise, I'm not entirely sure how we fit in, but I'd be happy to entertain all suggestions. Do you have any that you want to?
No, that's why I'm asking. Just speaking from a perspective, our philosophy is very much about
the Well, let's talk afterward.
Randy.
Randy Gears from the Viper Initiative. Corinne said that not enough work had been done on root causes. I'd like to know if the rest of the panel shares that, and if so, why, and if not, what should we be looking at in terms of root causes? Research that's been done so far.
Well, I'll just say to begin with that my friend Mark Sageman has one of the driest wits in Washington, and when he applauded the group for doing evidence-based research, I think he was intimating that there had been not enough of that sort of thing done in the field. And it's no secret that counterterrorism or terrorism studies, at least certainly before 2001, was a rather impoverished discipline. There's now an army of researchers setting a new agenda for study. There certainly needs to be a lot more work, but Mark's book is often, and I think appropriately, hailed as one of the first genuinely empirical studies of terrorist behavior, and it's thrown in particular a bright light on the issue of group dynamics and why people do truly horrible things. In terms of specifics of poverty, education, and the like, there's a growing mass of statistics that we can look at. In my view, the greatest problem is that there's a disconnect between what's being discovered and policy. And part of that is because we've gone down a particular policy road in which those statistics seem to be fairly irrelevant. I would defer to Mark as to what he thinks the state of the field is and where we should be looking. I would add one thing, and that is that as our discussions in the dialogue time and again pointed out, we in the United States have a particular problem because we have been hobbled, and I hate people who make this argument, but I'm going to become one of them. We've been hobbled by our own political correctness and unwillingness to study our own minorities because of the fear of, treading on toes or wading into areas we wouldn't want to. But it remains a fact that just the basic demographics of the Muslim community in America remain opaque, in part because of our census procedures and in part because people haven't wanted to get into that. And as a result, we have this completely unedifying battle between different interest groups as to just the basic size of the community. How many Muslims are there in America remains unclear. So anyway, Mark.
Ryan, I can always answer a question by asking you a question. What do you mean by root causes?
You didn't want to go that far.
The question basically implies that there are some root causes, and the way we think about it is really mostly a structural, functional way. And the problem with that type of perspective is that they probably is not an answer if you look at it from this point of view, because many countries share the same structural dynamics, but very few people become terrorists. So they all suffer from what I would call the fundamental problem of specificity, what makes this guy a terrorist as opposed to thousands of him that share the same situation. So a way of getting around that is probably looking at mechanism, processes by which people become terrorists. And what we're finding out, even in Europe or here, is that there is no one mechanism. It turns out that people become terrorists many different ways. It's a little bit like, who was that? Was it Dostoevsky who said, like, every happy family is...
No, it was Tolstoy.
Tolstoy, I'm sorry. it's happy the same way, but every unhappy family is unhappy its own way. And I think that probably also is true for, quote, root causes of terrorism.
Dan, I think we want to get Karen
in. Can I just also comment on that, too? I organized a meeting in September 2002 in New York for the OECD, because they, a lot of the development agencies have been wrestling with this. What do we do to get at root causes? What can development aid do? And we brought in some terrorism experts who had been focusing on this for 20, 30 years. And one of the interesting things that they raised was that this is the first time I've even thought about that challenge, about tying development aid into dealing with this. And I have done more work since then with the Danes and other donors, and part of the problem is, precisely as Mark was saying, we don't really understand enough what the root causes are to be developing policies. But even if you say at a level where we can make a contribution, like let's support education, et cetera, very little has been done at that level as well. So at the practical level, if you look at what's happened in a number of parts of the world where we claim we are addressing these things, we've done very little at that level.
And just to build on that, in our first round of these dialogues, kind of phase one, we looked at three issues: the role of development assistance, we looked at demographics, and we looked at how do you counter the role of radical Muslim NGOs around the world. And what we found is the experts in these topics actually rarely had the chance to come together as Europeans and Americans. We had a terrific session where we had UK experts on development assistance and American experts sit down and talk about kind of the strategies. Have they decided to reallocate resources in any way to so development assistance could be used as a national security tool? And a very frank and open exchange. We found a lot of these people had never met. There's a core of transatlantic experts that, you know, fly back and forth across the Atlantic all the time. We know who these people are. But we don't find that the scholars of Islam or the demographers or a lot of the quote-unquote experts in these other areas get the chance to sit down with their European counterparts or their American counterparts and drill down on the quote-unquote root causes. I think John or
Esther.
Thank you. Thank you to the panel. It's a fascinating topic and a fascinating report, and I applaud your work. Esther Brimmer, Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins. I want to follow on this question a little from a slightly different angle, which is, in a sense, we refer to marginalization and your target, and it's for very different reasons, as you've said. But I wanted to ask you, in your analysis, did you break apart, for example, political marginalization, how many people are even citizens and therefore even part of the political process, social marginalization, education? Did you go to that level? And if so, did you look at, in a sense, where blockages were? Because in a sense, we may be talking about different types of marginalization, different societies that lead to different remedies. And I just wondered if that came up in your analysis.
In trying to sum up a lot of different discussions, I think actually the conclusion was that if you try to break these things down, if you try to parse it too much, you'll actually lose – the phenomenon will fall through your fingers. The research suggests, for example, that you find in lots of terrorist cells people who are highly educated as well as people who are scrambling to make ends meet as day laborers, and that in fact it is a set of radical propositions that bring them together that actually create the glue that they share. What there is running through what they all share is a sense of embattlement and a sense that they're and many different kinds of deprivation or marginalization have fed into this, but they translate it typically into a religious idiom in which they view themselves as being isolated, oppressed, attacked, and their faith is under fire. And so it's actually that process of transmutation by which different kinds of deprivation, alienation, marginalization are turned into a sense of religious opposition that is really the key, it seems to me. But again, I defer to Mark, as I do in so many things.
Yes, we did kind of pass it out. In a way, there's so many different pathways to become marginalized, but what's common to all of them is that they have similar script. And it's really the script that brings them together. And the script is actually a very simple one. It's one that's been floating around for a century and a half, and one that I believe myself most of the time, namely that corruption is greed, greed is capitalism, capitalism is the U.S. So it's a crisis of value. Now, different people at different time had different ways to remedy this. But they all centered around building an ideal world, building a better world, a utopia. And their utopia really models what they think was the community of the prophet. And they want to do it violently because in a hurry. And so that's really what they had in common. I mean, the anarchists had a very different way of looking at it. The anti-colonialists, another way of, you know, they thought paradise will come if you kick out the colonial powers. And the leftists that we even had in this country, you know, that dream collapsed with collapse of the Soviet Union, but it also was already collapsing in the late 70s and 80s. So you can see basically young people chasing a dream, and they actually do feel marginalized for very many reasons, as you just pointed it out. But they need to have that script.
Yeah, thank you. John Sandrock from the Atlantic Council. I actually have about two, three quick points, and I'll try to make them really quick. After March 2003, the 3/11 attacks in Madrid,
2004.
There was a automatic attitude that what happened in Madrid was was a result of the U.S. actions prior to that in Afghanistan and in Iraq. This was also then echoed, I guess, with March 2004. But
yes.
This was also echoed to some extent. London has been called on to account in a lot of different things. I know you alluded to that. I wonder to what extent the official attitude, and perhaps has changed, which I agree with in my own conversations on these issues, it has changed, but why that hasn't really washed down to the popular attitude. The next point is...
I'm sorry. Can you just clarify that? I'm not sure what your distinction was between the official and the popular.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the popular perception is that the U.S. is still at fault for a lot of the kind of terrorist acts and the threat of terrorism, and that the U.S. is at fault because of Afghanistan and Iraq. And I'm not sure that opinion is necessarily shared at the level of wisdom, the level of those people who actually look at terrorism. To one of which that can be reversed. And then you have the whole succession of things, and you also alluded to those, is Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, the renditions. And I wonder if your interlocutors in Europe, might not have perceived this as some kind of a orchestrated series of events. Is there anybody behind this, or is this a conspiracy theory that doesn't hold water? Also, in UK, did you talk with Iqbal Sakrani, and did you contact the Muslim Council of Britain at all to see what their attitudes were? And then finally, Gabi Wyman and Ruben Paz are probably the world's best experts on the use of the internet by Islamists. And I wonder if anybody raised any issues on how to counter that. I mean, it's all well and good for them to point out that what is being used and the number of terrorist websites and fatwas online and all the rest of that. I wonder if anybody has thought of how to kind of cope with that and turn that around, or at least provide a separate message or a different message. Sorry to give you several points there.
No, buckshot's perfectly acceptable as a questioning method. Well, I'll go very rapidly and then let the other panelists take a cut. I mean, in our discussions of what's driven the attacks in Europe, you know, the issues that we've discussed were very much, you know, at the fore in terms of the broader context. At the same time, and I don't at the moment recall exactly how precisely we discussed all these things, but in every case, you know, certainly U.S. deeds, U.S. acts have been cited by those people who carried out the attacks, and I think that among most analysts, they're viewed as having some triggering quality. I mean, it is clear, for example, in the case of Madrid, that the two things that really drove the cell, one was the arrest of a lot of their friends after 9/11, and the other was Iraq. They were absolutely transfixed by Iraq. They were watching tapes and exulting, for example, in the slaughter of a group of Spanish intelligence agents who were killed in Iraq, and they kept saying, well, Iraq, Spain needs to be punished for its support in Iraq. That obviously maybe at the level of, you know, the epiphenomena, not the broader phenomena, but nonetheless it's very important. Similar things were true in among the Leeds crowd that bombed the London subways, and as I discussed with Mohamed Bouyeri, there was this merger of local and global human rights excesses. Is there anybody behind this? Is there a conspiracy? I'm not exactly sure what you mean. We're dealing with, if you're talking about those who are prone to radical thoughts, you know, conspiracy theory is the air they breathe. But no matter what, you know, there were news items, and they found it easy to weave these into their worldview as being more examples of the effort of the U.S. and the West to oppress Muslims. I'm not sure if I understood the question correctly. Have I answered it in suggesting that I did understand it, or?
Keep the U.S., the perspective on the U.S., in Europe at least, and other places, in a very low profile, or a very low light. In other words, we don't get everything on the table at once. Let's deal with it. Let's get it over with. There's a succession of things. New pictures from Abu Ghraib released. They hit the news. The renditions hit the news. So on and so forth. They almost seem to be time-phased in order to keep the attitude in such a way. And I wonder if there was any kind of a thought that this might be an orchestrated series of events, rather than just kind of coming by accident as they are discovered.
Well, my own off the top of my head surmise is they are orchestrated by the logic of capitalism and the press. That is to say, the press is always working to find these now that the story's been established, and therefore they come out with some, you know, periodic fashion.
You don't think they're fed to the press?
They may be fed by people inside the U.S. government to the press with some regularity, but I don't think they're being fed by outside conspirators who have no access to classified information.
Dan, can I just make a comment on
sure.
that? Because I was in the U.K. for all the period of time since September 11th, and the one thing the government kept saying over and over again was, we will have an attack. I don't think, you know, the Brits were anticipating it, so when it did happen in July, I don't think the vast majority of Brits thought, oh, this is because of our invasion of Iraq, or this is because of this, because they have been anticipating for so long, and they were actually much calmer about it, probably because they had been prepared by the government.
I see in my notes that I've missed question three, so let me answer question four, and then you can tell me again what question three was. Weimann and Paz. Well, unfortunately, we had someone who was on par with them here just moments ago, who was a participant in the dialogue and who's just had to leave, I guess, Amy Ibrahim David, who studies the web in terms of technical innovations, particularly in bomb making and other tactical aspects. And I think actually the consensus that was built out of these discussions was that we need the web to know what's going on more than anything else. We don't have yet a very effective way of shutting down most of these sites. They always pop up again. And that given the nature of modern telecommunications and the wired world, there's not a technical way of dealing with this. There's ultimately going to have to be a, shall we say, a narrative way of dealing with it, and that is having another story that crowds out that one. And that's a ways off. Do you want to remind me what number three was?
I think it was Sakrani.
The Muslim Council.
Muslim Council. No, we did have representatives of different Muslim communities in Europe. We did not have someone from the Muslim Council in Britain in large measure because we haven't met yet in Britain. Although that's on the schedule, or tentatively on the schedule. Mark, did you have?
Yeah, in terms of the coordination, there was actual consensus that there was no coordination from the bad guys in that sense, and however you define the bad guys, whether it was in terms of the stories released in the press or And here I'm going to take the Danish cartoons out of this because we didn't really deal with the Danish cartoons. When we last met in December, it really did not surface again because it turns out I think that the key coordinating meeting was at the Hajj later on that month. So it was prior to the Danish cartoons. But otherwise, we didn't find any coordination, nor did we find any coordination for the various attacks. I mean, they all were fairly autonomous in that sense, with very little links to the outside.
Anyone else? Did Sean depart? He had a question. Well, he can ask it to us on the fifth floor.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Well, thank you so much for coming. We hope you'll read the report. I guess there are copies outside. And we look forward to your feedback on it. All the best.